Hi, I'm Kristen Cloak, and you are listening to the X-Cast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I am Tony Black, your host for Season 3, although we're not quite doing the X-Cast in terms of normal seasons, given we have breaks for, you know, Season 11, and then pod watches, and then roundtables, and goodness knows what else. But we are, nonetheless, beginning our coverage of the third season of The X-Files by talking about the premiere episode today, The Blessing Way. And I had to be joined by the man who hinted at his involvement in this episode a whole year ago when we talked about Anasazi. It's none other than Darren Mooney.
Yay! So my cunning plan to worm my way onto the third season of The X-Cast finally paid off. Now, thank you very much, Tony. It's a pleasure to be back. I do like, by the way, that you hint at like the little gap that you took between the second and third season that involved watching the entire show and releasing episodes daily and sometimes twice daily as kind of like a, remember that crazy stuff we did way back when?
Well, I'm finally now perhaps a little bit away from it to have the distance to go, how the hell did we do that? Like, I just can't even get my head around it. That we
everybody
actually...
else was asking that while you were doing it.
It was a pretty great achievement with, you know, a whole legion of podcasters, including yourself, which is amazing, really. So yeah, we've technically covered the entire X-Files on the X-Cast already, but we haven't gone in depth, which is what we're going to continue to do. Probably for the rest of my life at the rate this show takes to produce and the amount of episodes that are still to come. There's like 160, 150 odd episodes still to do in depth. But, you know, hopefully I will live long enough to complete this saga. And it's good to be back for season three, which kicks off, as we say, with The Blessing Way, which is the first episode of season three of The X-Files. It first aired on September the 22nd, 1995. Was written by Chris Carter and directed by R.W. Goodwin. And, of course, this episode continues where Anasazi left off. Mulder's presumed dead after being burned alive by the Smoky Man in a boxcar. Scully is with the Navajo Indians trying to figure out what's going on. And a lot of mystical stuff happens before we get to the third part of the trilogy, Paperclip, which obviously we'll be talking about soon. So, I mean, like I said, funnily enough, I listened back to Anasazi recently just to get a bit of a feel for our last conversation, which was this beast of a conversation. It was a fantastic chat that we had a year ago, a whole year ago, Darren. Time has flown by there.
And some of us are still trapped in the boxcar.
Well, exactly, yeah. We've just been given enough rations to survive over this last year. In that episode, as I say, there were hints that you didn't particularly love the middle part of this trilogy. So what do you think in broad terms about The Blessing Way?
I'm very much of two minds about the episode, which generally means that I like it a lot less than most other episodes of The X-Files. But in terms of like being nice, being polite, opening with the stuff that I actually really like about it is the fact that it is a very, very sharp left curveball sort of from Chris Carter. It's a moment where you've had this big, gigantic cliffhanger coming out of the second season, where you've got this huge question hanging over about what happens now. How does Mulder get out of this situation? How does he survive? And then you sort of come into the third season, which, you know, you've had like the first and second season, they've been, you know, gaining momentum as they've been going. People have been sort of talking about them. You've got like a platform now. You've got people are going to be tuning into the third season, having recently just caught up on the first and second. And they're waiting to see you go sort of rearing out of the gate with this sort of like continuing this epic conspiracy story about like this secret that dates back to even before the founding of America as a country. And then you have like Mulder lying under a bunch of leaves while ghosts of, you know, characters who are dead come and talk to him, quoting Hamlet and various other Shakespearean dialogue. And it's a very left field choice. Like I remember Kumail Nanjiani talked about it on the X-Files files with Kevin Smith. Who had an original fan experience. This was the first episode of The X-Files that he watched because he'd heard people talking about it so much and he caught reruns over the summer and he was in a motel. I think he was promoting one of his films at the time. He's like, look, The X-Files is on Fox tonight. This is like the biggest show of 1995. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to watch this. I'm actually going to watch an episode of The X-Files live. I'm going to jump on at this point. And at the end of it going, what the hell was that? There's an aspect of that which I really, really love. And I, like, as sarcastic as it sounds and as cynical as it sounds, I always love that about Carter. There's a, like an esoterical nature to Carter's writing, where Carter understands exactly what the audience expects and then doesn't give it to them. We talked a bit about it when we talked on the, you know, the Podwatchers season 11 stuff about how crazy the Carter's mythology episodes are now and how he seems to be doing whatever he wants to do. But he's always been doing that. And The Blessing Way is very much an example of that. The Blessing Way is an example of Carter taking everything that he should be doing on paper, everything that you would expect a show that's about to become a pop, you know, that is a pop cultural phenomenon, but is about to go supernova over the course of the next year and a half, and doing almost the exact literal opposite of it. There are long monologues, there are ghosts, there are abstract statements and, you know, philosophical conversations. There's like one moment where a character projects himself into the subconscious of another character, which, you know, no character ever really properly discusses again. They allude to it in the next episode, but it's not a big deal. And there's a lot of crazy, crazy stuff in here that feels like it's put all of the cliffhangers and all the big questions of the last episode on pause. Like, to the point where you don't, like, the point where the characters seem to shrug off the question of how Mulder got out of the boxcar, which is, to be clear, the cliffhanger of the second season. Everyone's kind of like, ah, he just got out. It doesn't really matter. And it's incredibly frustrating, which is why I don't like it as much as I like Anasazi or I like Paperclip, and why I would consider it one of the weaker episodes of the third season. And keep in mind, the third season is one of my favorite seasons of television ever, so that's not that big a criticism of it. But I admire it as much as I find it utterly hair-pullingly frustrating.
What would you give it out of 10?
Probably go with a 3 or a 4. Ooh. Let's go with a 4. Let's feel generous.
That is quite low. That is quite low. I can totally see where you're coming from, really. I mean, I think I'd probably go for maybe between a 6 and a 7 myself, really. Because it is very different from Anasazi. You know, it's like a completely different episode. I mean, obviously it's a different episode, but it doesn't even feel like it fits in many ways with Anasazi. You know, it's got a lot of different kind of aspects to it. It doesn't have that same level of propulsion that Anasazi has. You know, it doesn't have that same level of sheer massive volumes of plot going on. You know, it's just, it sort of takes a pause, takes a breath, which is unusual for a season premiere. I mean, it's so different from Little Green Men. You know, when you compare the two, Little Green Men was almost like a second pilot and then, you know, reintroducing everything. This is just one of those episodes that just expects you to know what has happened, gives you a little bit of a recap, and then we're off. So we're not really off, because it's more like a pause. It's more like a little, you know, gap between Paperclip, which is that's when we're off again. That's when the plot kicks back in and it's, you know, it's all action stations. But, you know, and I think so it's one of those things where it probably could have, do you think this could have been a two-parter really, and it didn't have to be three?
And again, this is why I don't necessarily like giving numerical scores, because I admire this even if I don't like it. And I think that the three-parter, there's a weird, strange tempo, and I watch, and it's actually strange because it was obviously, I'm not sure it was entirely meant to be watched as like a 2-hour movie where you watch all three episodes back to back. But when you do that, the Blessing Way almost gets a bit of a lift in some respects, because it does feel like a breather of a second act. It's sort of, you get that contrast, because you pointed out like Anasazi is go, 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 tempo, tempo, tempo. And Paperclip, you know, not to spoil next week or when we're releasing the episode, but, you know, Paperclip is go, 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 tempo, tempo, tempo. So like, The Blessing Way, you know, kind of plays better in the middle of those than it does, you know, if you're watching it after 3 months of summer, or if you're watching it sort of, you know, waiting a week and then watching Paperclip. So I like the idea of a breather, and I particularly like the idea of a breather in the middle of like this gigantic epic story. Because the traditional thing to do would be to have the gigantic epic story and then have like a quiet coda afterwards. And I think, like, say, you know, other shows, like, say, Star Trek would do that quite regularly, where you'd have cliffhanger, like Picard gets assimilated, and then you do a quiet episode where he goes to France and, you know, visits his brother. Or, you know, there's war with the Klingons, and then you do a quiet little episode where, you know, Sisko gets lost in time and spends a lot of time connecting with his son. Or, you know, like the, you know, the whole big Dominion War, and then you have a quiet episode where Sisko and his son basically build a spaceship and fly together through the cosmos in this sort of touching father-son thing. Here you get that sort of almost breather. And you want, and to be honest, like, there's a lot, there is a bit of tension in here, because obviously the Scully plot's still going in the background. But the Mulder plot literally feels like a timeout. Mulder goes, lies down, drinks some water, gets a nice, you know, sort of bath, like, gets to recover his senses and gets to come back, like, refreshed and renewed for, like, the second half of his journey. And I like it, even if I don't think it works as well as it could, even if I don't think it kind of, and I admire the ambition of it. And I feel like if it was two parts and it was relatively straightforward, maybe I'd like it more, but it would be different, and you'd change it, and I feel like you'd lose something in doing that. Like, I think I talked about this, like, in the context of saying this wasn't my favorite episode. I think that came up when we were talking about, like, is this three-parter your favorite mythology episode ever? And I was like, no, I actually much prefer Nicey and 731 or Patient X and the Red and the Black, which are, you know, much more propulsive and sort of much more clinical and much more traditionally structured. But I do admire this three-parter because it is so, so strange.
Yeah. You know, when we talked to Nanasazi, you know, it's one of those stories that really does elevate the show. You know, it puts it on a different level in many ways, you know, and it really transforms it. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get into that as we talk, but it is an interesting midpoint, really, of probably the most famous trilogy the X-Files ever did. On IMDb, obviously, we always have a look at the ratings on IMDb, and it gets an 8.8 out of 10, which is quite high, wow, actually. You know, it's not the top-rated episode of the season, but it beats things like Nisei. It beats things like Piper Maru. I know. I mean, bear in mind that, you know, IMDb is not a reliable aggregator.
What, you mean, you know, Infinity War isn't the 15th best movie of all time?
I know. The shock of it. That's a nice little hint to go and listen to the 250, guys, covering Avengers. Listen to the 250 anyway, the podcast, but listen to the one with Infinity War, because we're both on that.
We got a great guest for that one. Yeah. I mean, it was fantastic. No idea how we pulled it.
I was going to say, he couldn't turn up, so I came in. But yeah, it's done pretty well out of 2,722 votes. So yeah, it's pretty good. Let's play a little game. What do you think the highest rated and the lowest rated season 3 episodes are?
Okay, let's start with the lowest rated one and go with Tezos Dos Bichos.
By an absolute country mile. It's like, I'm going to save for the episode when we get there.
What the score actual is.
The number. You can, of course, go and look it up. But yeah, what about the highest rated?
Oh, highest rated one is tough. There's a lot of great episodes. The third season of The X-Files is, again, one of the great episodes, great, you know, 20-odd episode seasons of television ever made. And also there's a lot of candidates. And it's like, not only that, you're playing against it. It's like, is it the Generation Game or Family Fortunes, where it's not so much that you're trying to guess what is the best. You're trying to guess what people think is the best and
that's
what IMDb
Fortunes.
Voters. Yeah. That's Family Fortunes.
Family Feud in the US, I think it might have been called. Yeah,
but yeah, there's a game. There's sort of like a playing the audience aspect here, where like I'm like, if I were talking to hardcore X-Files fans, I'd go with like Jose Chung or Clyde Brookman. But because this is the IMDb, I'm kind of wondering, is it possibly Paperclip?
Well, that's an interesting response, because the top rated one is actually Clyde Brookman.
Ooh.
But only
do
a
I get
point...
the toaster, Tony?
You do. You don't get the cuddly toy because it was one above Paperclip. So Paperclip is 9.2. I think Paperclip's the second highest rated. And then I think it's Jose Chung after that, funnily enough. So you're in the right ballpark. And I think on the whole, people tend to agree that those are the three strongest of the season. Which, I'll be honest, I think that's fair dues, really. There's some fantastic episodes. Well, except Pusher. Obviously Pusher's 10. Obviously. But anyway, we'll get to that. we'll get to that in time. Let's, without further ado then, let's talk in more depth about the Blessing Way. So yeah, The Blessing Way obviously picks up straight away from the events of Anasazi, but it kind of goes into one of Chris Carter's, you know, lovely little preamble sort of monologues, which he likes which he likes to do, and this time it's Albert Hostein. Yeah, I am probably going to butcher his accent all the way through trying to do Albert Hostein impressions. I'm sorry in advance. But he starts talking about... To be honest, I actually quite liked his opening sort of monologue where he talks about memory like fire. You know, he's radiant and immutable. These kind of... It's quite poetic, I think, what he says. And he's, you know, he's talking very much about how, you know, it is about the core concepts. We talked about this in the Anasazi episode about memory and, you know, the crimes of the past and the sins of the fathers and all this kind of thing. And he's sort of talking about that in this opening monologue, really.
Yeah, he is. I mean, there's a lot of really great thematic stuff here. And like as much as Carter gets criticized for his monologues, like a lot of them are actually very good and interesting thematic statements, a very nice philosophical sort of like things to think about and things to digest. I think sort of Carter gets into trouble because he doesn't necessarily sort of pare them down and he doesn't integrate them into dialogue. He just sort of puts them out up front. Because I mean, like the thing about memory is like memory is obviously a huge theme of this particular episode. Like you have, for example, Scully going to hypnosis later on or going to hypnotherapy later on to remember her experience, which obviously mirrors like Mulder's experiences, which brought him to the X-Files, the hypnotherapy, that where he remembered that Samantha had been taken. And obviously memory plays throughout the X-Files. I mean, you have this idea of even the tape that's the focus of the episode, you know, not to get too specific or too spoilery, but it ends up becoming part of like the oral tradition of something that's remembered as much as something that actually physically exists and is recorded. And so like you have that theme running through the episode, which is very potent, and which like, again, one of the things that I think the third season does really well, and we'll probably talk about it as we go on into The Blessing Way, but it's got this wonderful thematic consistency through it. And I mean, like, we talked about this in the podcast before, where you can criticize Carter for some of the finer details of his plotting and some of the mechanics of how he tells his stories and even some of the continuity. And I mean, there's one very, very big example in The Blessing Way of Carter's like lack of, you know, necessarily planning or foresight or even just misleading the audience. But when it comes to themes, the third season has this really strong theme, the rest of the show does as well, but the third season in particular has this idea of memory and history and intersection. So obviously this leads into the next mythology two-parter, which is, you know, Nicene 731, which is about like the experiments conducted during the Second World War. And then that goes into like Piper Maru and Apocrypha, which is, you know, about trying to recover a lost, well, you know, cover story, including involving an attempt to recover a lost atomic bomb from the Second World War. And so you have this idea of legacy and history and memory that plays through the season. And it's all set up here, even in this like weird, quiet breather episode. And like, I feel like Carter's monologues, they get criticism because they take all that subtext and they just sort of make it text. They put it directly in front of you. And they sort of, I think Chris Knowles, when I was talking to Chris Knowles a little while ago, I think on the Podwatch, he likened Carter's writing to that of, say, comic book writers like Stan Lee or Chris Claremont. And you can almost, like, when you're watching it, imagine the little yellow box of text saying, you know, memory like fire is radiant and immutable, while history serves only those who seek to control it. And it kind of, I like it, but it is a bit much, and there's a lot of it here. And it kind of paves the way for the next time that Carter would write the middle episode of a season bridging trilogy, not to spoil season 5 of the X-Cast.
Yeah. I mean, we're a while away from that. But what do you think this is better than Redox? I mean, what would you say? I mean, because they are, in some ways, there's a similarity, certainly in what you've been talking about. Which one would you say from this distance is better?
The whole thing or the episode?
That specific episode, yeah.
Okay. I would say that specific episode is a little better. I would say this entire three-parter is a little better.
They both, I mean, Redox really goes for it with the monologues, doesn't it? I mean, there's more in that than this one. There's a couple in this one, there's a few, but that one is just wall-to-wall monologue. So, yeah, I suppose.
It's monologuing in corridors. It's like if Aaron Sorkin wrote a one-man play.
Yeah, about UFOs. Oh, God, please make that happen, Aaron. If you're listening to this, come on. But, yeah, it's an interesting start anyway, you know, and it sets up the... you know, the Navajos being very central to, you know, thematically into the story of this episode. But obviously, we're with Scully for the first chunk of the episode. In fact, really, I mean, I know centrally this whole thing is about Mulder and what's happened to Mulder and everything, but this is far more of a Scully episode, really, isn't it, than Mulder's? Because she has to carry the actual weight of the story. You know, she goes back to the FBI. People are, you know, she's got helicopters intercepting her on the road looking for this digital tape, and she's going back to the FBI and they're putting her on, you know, leave without pay, which is a real kick in the, you know, proverbials as well. Yeah, we're gonna put you on leave and you're not gonna get paid. Sorry. And you've got, you know, you've got Skinner having to very much play that middle distance. So there's a lot going on with Scully, even more than Mulder in this. And it takes rewatching it, especially watching it in isolation, which is what I've certainly done for this, to realise that actually it stands out more.
It does. I mean, I think Carter's talked about how it was a conscious effort to shift the storytelling sort of onus from Mulder, who drove a lot of Anasazi, to Scully, who obviously drives a lot of the Blessing Way. And I think that there's a lot of stuff here which sets up, like, one of the things, and again, I feel like when I'm talking about the Blessing Way, I'm actually saying, well, I really like the third season as a whole. But no, I mean, it speaks to how well Carter's, I don't know if planned is the right word, but how well he understood where he was going with the season. That one of the things the third season does remarkably well, and I think I sort of alluded to it when we talked about the mythology episodes of the second season, particularly how they treat Scully, where she gets abducted and then dropped back and returned and she's unconscious in a hospital. And then even like in, say, Colony and Endgame, she's, you know, held hostage again. And, you know, then you have the climax at the end of Our Town and stuff like that. You have a lot of Scully in peril in the second season and a lot of questions of how to write around Gillian Anderson's pregnancy without necessarily thinking about what that says about Scully as a character or how that affects her arc. There's a sense of, like, it takes her until irresistible to process what's happened to her. And even then, there's a sense that she's not fully through it. Whereas the third season, it feels like at some point over the summer, all the writers sat down, they said, well, look, what Scully's been through means something and we have to deal with it. We have to actually process through it. And you get a lot of that in the third season where you have this recurring theme of like control over women's bodies, which obviously plays into, like, it fits within the whole big, like, metaphor about like state violence and about the way in which society oppresses people and, you know, minorities. Like, for example, you have the Native Americans, the Navajo, who are victimized in the opening scene of the episode with the U.S. Army coming onto their property, waving machine guns around, beating them up and demanding that they surrender anything they might be holding. But you also have that with Scully, whose body has been violated, whose reproductive organs have been controlled by, you know, old men with white hair and fancy suits. And you see, even in the Blessing Way, you see a sort of a shift back towards recognizing that, like, Scully's plot in the second season, like writing Scully out so Gillian Anderson could give birth, you know, meant sacrificing a lot of Scully's agency. But, like, the third season in episodes like, say, you know, Nicey in 731 and later on Piper Maru in Apocrypha, you have this idea of, like, giving it back or acknowledging that it was taken and acknowledging that this is part of Scully's journey. And, like, Scully's, so you see that in The Blessing Way, where Scully basically is left running around. She's left without Mulder. She's sort of pushed out, as you pointed out, on leave without pay. She's sort of dismissed by Skinner. Skinner doesn't seem to treat her with any respect in this episode. You know, in Paperclip, we get a sort of a different angle of it. And you have her discovering that not only, you know, has she got a chip in the back of her neck that's apparently been there since she was abducted and nobody pointed it out and she didn't even realize it was there, but you also have then her going to hypnotherapy and her remembering what happened to her in a way that's more vivid and more literal than anything that had been expressed in the second season. And there's a real sense that the show is willing finally to deal with the trauma that it inflicted on Scully. I don't mean that as a criticism of the second season, because I understand the second season was written under a great deal of pressure with Anderson gone, but I really think it speaks to the power of the third season, that you're willing to come back and to flesh this aspect out and to deal with it. And I think The Blessing Way kind of does that. But I also feel like naming the episode The Blessing Way, which is the ritual that Mulder undergoes, kind of leads you, when you're watching it, particularly in like a three episode block, to think of this as like a really dull part of Mulder's score, a story.
Yeah, because it's sort of suggesting that that's the most important aspect and the core of it. A lot of what Scully goes through in this is about reacting to what's happening to Mulder. But what is good, you know, like you said, there is a chunk of this that isn't about Mulder at all. Now, it's about what happened to her. It's about the chip. It's about the hypnosis. It's about how, you know, that the moment that struck me was when she's in the hypnotherapy session with Dr. Pomerantz, and she's in the middle of it all, and he says, you know, take a breath and try again. He puts his hand on her lap, you know, on her, and she jerks away quickly. You know, now that it never quite struck me in the same way as it does in this day and age, especially after everything you see Scully go through over the show, that's a really sort of vivid, you know, it's where he places his hands. You know, it's quite obvious
what this symbolizes, right, or what the violence she's been through represents.
Mm, and you don't always get that. You didn't get that. I didn't get that in much earlier. You know, it's one of those things that really stands out. So it's quite good the way it pays it off much better later, but it sets up these aspects with Scully very well. And I think, like you said, going back to this and doing more with it is a good move, really. And I suppose it gives the episode a little bit more than the mysticism that drives the rest of it.
Yeah, but the issue, I think, with the mysticism is so much more memorable, because, like, Scully's plot is primarily about her realizing that something happened and either not being able to accomplish much. So, for example, bringing that information on Kenneth Suna to Skinner and getting shot down. Or, and completely understandably, like, it's completely in character, it makes a great deal of sense, and it's the right storytelling choice to have her back away from the revelations in the hypnotherapy session, to refuse to go back and to try again, because obviously it's a huge traumatic experience for her. But it does mean that she sort of hits a brick wall repeatedly over the course of the episode, whereas the more memorable parts of The Blessing Way are the bits where Albert Hochstein is talking at great length about how the buzzard is a large but cowardly bird. Because that's what you remember. That's what you take out of the episode, you know?
It's true. If there wasn't so much going on in Paperclip, you'd mainly be remembering talking about the buffalo.
Buffalo, that's it, exactly. The buffalo's all at the start. Like, it's like, imagine if he interrupted sort of the climax of Paperclip, like when they're in the middle of the mine and he just had Alfred Hochstein sort of cut over and voiceover and that scene with the buffalo. It wouldn't quite work.
The buffalo is a big beast. Yeah. Thanks, Albert. Yeah. Just, you know, shh. We're in the middle
Not
of the
right
end,
now.
Albert. Just leave it. But yeah, it does have... you know, an interesting mix of these different styles. But obviously, as Scully's, it started to get embroiled in this in these two aspects. You know, the digital tape stuff and everything with the chip. We also start to see the bigger, wider sort of expanse of the Smoking Man's world, don't we? And this, you know, seeing the Syndicate for the first time as they're known, they're not really referred to in this episode, I don't believe, as the Syndicate. I think it's a while until they're called it. You know, the closest we get
they're
is a
consortium.
The well-manicured man saying we're a consortium of global interests. Because obviously before, the conspiracy has sort of been actualized with the Smoking Man. You know, we've seen this guy for two seasons. In the first season, he's just this, you know, shadowy bloke in a suit. Second season, we start to get a character, you know, once we get to One Breath and then beyond. And especially by Anasazi, we've then got a villain. You know, we've really fleshed it out to be have a proper villain. But now, obviously, he's part of a machine. He's a cog in a bigger machine. And I love this. When I first watched this, you know, back when it aired, you know, 1995 when it was on Sky in the UK, I loved the mystery of the Syndicate. I loved the enigma. You know, you didn't know who these people were. Even Mark Snow's music is this tinkling little piano and, you know, who are these guys? And I'd love that about it. But I mean, what do you think it does to the Smoking Man's character, really? Because if you think about it, while Manicured Man is an important character, you know, in some ways, and, you know, we get more of him later, once they realise, you know, we cast John Neville, this guy's awesome, let's do lots with him. But do you think it changes the Smoking Man's position in the show once we start to see him as part of this group and not the complete aspect of the conspiracy?
Well, I mean, I think, to be honest, part of it was necessary. I think part of it was, like, there's only so far you can take the Smoking Man as an ominous, nebulous representation of evil. And I think you can sort of see that in the difficulty that the show had after the Syndicate. Now, I'm not going to be too specific in case people are watching it the first time around with us. But, like, obviously there's a point later on where the show moves past the Syndicate as primary villains, but it keeps the Cigarette Smoking Man around. And you see that when that happens, there's not really very much that you can do with him outside of just play with him as an archetype. And some of that is interesting, but it's not as rewarding. He never feels as much like a real person as he does sort of with the existence of the syndicate and the consortium. Like, there's something really, really impressive about the idea of, like, the smoking man, who to Mulder is this ominous representation of everything wrong with the US government, being presented as effectively a mid-level bureaucrat who is completely insecure and incompetent in his station. Like, one of the, and I think we pointed this out when we were doing Anasazi, the great thing about the three-parter is that the conspiracy itself is ridiculously incompetent. Like, there's a real sense of, like, the Peter principle in effect here, where the cigarette smoking man has somehow got himself, like, positioned, like, as far as it is possible to go, and got himself positioned at least one rung on the ladder above his capacity to handle, at least it, at this point in the series. And it works really well because it gives you a sense of the smoking man, like, being real, but also, like, existing in a larger context. Because, like, this is the thing with the third season. The show's running now been running for 2 years. And the third season, there's a sort of a sense that you're a success now. The show is a success now. So Carter has to begin the process of, like, streamlining it and making it clear what it is, and, like, building, like, actually fashioning it into a mythology. Because I think we talked about it when we talked about, like, the mythology episodes of the second season. They're great. They're fantastic. They're really clever. But they don't really fit together easily enough. But what the you know, conspiracy or the syndicate allows Carter to do is to start bringing stuff together and telling a self-contained story. Like, the mythology in the third season, like, it flows much more smoothly. Whatever about the quality of the individual episodes, and again, I love Nicey and 731, there's a much more organic sort of flow to it than there was in the first season, where there weren't really mythology episodes, and the second season, where you had mythology episodes as event episodes. Here, there's a sense that there's an actual world that exists and something that is happening, some sort of project that is in process, some sort of, like, end towards which they are building. And I mean, you get that, like, it's telling that you get the big reveal of what the project is at the end of the third season, even though it's quite clear thematically what it absolutely has to be. And I really, really like that. And I think there's something, like, the existence of the syndicate makes that evil relatable and personable. And I mean, like, we know next to nothing about First Elder, aside from the fact that he's a passable Marlon Brando impersonator. We know very little about, like, the second and third Elders beyond what they look like and how they read lines. But they still feel real and tangible in a way that what the show tried to do once it moved past the syndicate never quite worked. Like, you'll never get the conspiracy scenes that are as effective as a bunch of these old, like, white guys who are really good thespians bouncing off one another in a smoky, sort of dimly lit New York room. And it's remarkable. It works really, really well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I always really liked it, you know, and I think, yeah, bringing in the well-manicured man, you know, I'm a big fan of his. I love that character. I love the actor playing him as well. You know, I think he was a really great addition, you know, and he gets a few moments in this, particularly his conversation with Scully, where you start to see, you know, there is this interesting, different kind of character in this setup, you know, because he's, I mean, for a start, he's not American, you know, and that sort of adds to the whole aspect, you know, we talked about in Anasazi about, you know, when the tape is exposed and Smoking Man's getting calls from half a dozen different countries, you know, saying it's not us, nothing to do with us.
Everybody who lost the Second World War, which is exactly. Quite nice. And I also like that means the well manicured man as a British character is kind of plays into that, because he's technically one of the good guys of history. Although you see that he's been rendered complicit. And like, as you pointed out, his arc over the rest of the show is phenomenal. I mean, like, he has a really great arc between here and the end of the fifth season, which is just, Neville's fantastic. The character is amazing. And, like, you get a taste of that even here. I think you alluded to the scene between Scully and the well-manicured man, where they have the conversation and he's basically, you know, few motives are selfless, which is, like, you're saving this woman's life. You could at least pretend like you give a damn. Yeah. But he's very explicit about why he's doing it. Obviously, the searing contempt that you get of the smoking man as it goes along. And the sense that, like, even in this episode, The Blessing Way, there's a weird sense that the well-manicured man sort of is resentful of what he's a part of. He's sort of, he finds it distasteful, and not enough that he'd actually, like, stop it yet, or not enough that he'd actually not be a part of it, But there's a sense that on some level, the thuggery of it almost, the violence of it, the brutality of it, is something that unsettles him. And it's a really great degree of nuance, like in the X-Files. Like, because up until this point, it's, you know, shadowy conspiracies, it's shape-shifting aliens, it's like people from the CIA sort of wheeling out, you know, dead bodies or hiding aliens. And, you know, obviously you have Deep Throat, who feels guilty about maybe shooting that alien that time. But here you have like a sense of a character who's not directly interacting with Mulder and Scully on a regular basis, but who still has his own like character arc playing out against the backdrop of the mythology. Because Deep Throat, we only really saw from Mulder's perspective. Like, I mean, we don't find out that his first name is Ronald, I think, until the musings of a cigarette smoking man. And then that, I was really, part of me kind of admired that that was confirmed in the reboot, we're gonna make musings of a cigarette smoking man canon if it's the last thing that we do. But here you get a sense of like the smoking man, not the smoking man, the well-mannered man having like a life that extends beyond Mulder and Scully. And I like that. I like that a lot.
Well, I mean, in future episodes, you know, which obviously we'll get into, you know, he doesn't have many scenes with either of them. I think this might be his only scene with Scully. And I think he has maybe two more with Mulder. I think he maybe speaks to him in maybe Apocrypha and then Fight the Future. I think everything else, it's with other characters, you know. And that's rare, you know. That is rare because it's just, he's one of those characters. He kind of doesn't need them, you know. He doesn't need to have the interactions with them to be compelling. And, you know, you get that. You said it very well. You know, you get that sense of a guy who is, you know, a little bit, you know, there's dimensions to him already. And, you know, I mean, it could well be, you know, partly down to the actor. I mean, John Neville is, you know, he's playing classical British here, but he was a Canadian national for, like, decades. But he started in, like, the 50s with, you know, in things like The Old Vic. You know, he was on stage with, like, Judi Dench and Olivier and all these people. So, yeah, he goes back to the old sort of, you know, classical, early, when he was young, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you know, the kind of, you know, British theatre.
Ian McKellen sort of thing, yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah. He was with them. He was with one of those guys. But then he emigrated to Canada. So he kind of never quite achieved the fame. You know, he was memorably in Baron Munchausen by Terry Gilliam, but he never became a household name, you know, like in the same way as McKellen or Judi Dench or these kind of people. Which is a shame because he's a superb actor, a real casting coup. And he does put that, you know, that level onto the character straight away. And, you know, it helps expand this, you know, consortium out in a really interesting way. You know, my favorite line of the episode is from him, where he says, "We predict the future, and the best way to predict the future is to invent it." And he says it was such a mischief, doesn't he?
He's practically smirking as he says it. It's
he
like,
really is.
It is kind of like one of those, what I do is kind of cool, I guess, exactly. When I can convince my mates not to try and murder you.
But no, it is really good. It's a great little performance. But it sort of plays into the, you know, the intrigue aspect of the episode, which is separate from the other elements, which is Scully caught up in this hunt for the digital tape, you know, which ultimately ends up, of course, getting her sister Melissa killed. And I mean, what about Melissa in terms of this? Because obviously this is a big moment, really, you know. And obviously she doesn't die until the next episode, but it's a big moment for Scully, in terms of, you know, obviously she and Mulder by the end of Paperclip have both lost somebody. But Melissa getting caught up in this and being brought back to be killed off, I mean, was this a mistake? I mean, should they have kept her around more? Because in one breath you had a really interesting character set up there, you know. I mean, there were even flickers and hints, and I think we may have talked about this in the episode when we called One Breath, about a possible, you know, set level of attraction with Mulder. I don't know. They could have gone down different roads with Melissa. I mean, what do you think about this? Do you think it was a good move, what they do?
I find it very cynical. And like, I admire it from a narrative and storytelling construction point of view. And it's telling, like, for example, I think Paperclip opens with a monologue from Hosteen again, talking about the buffalo. But he's also talking about, I think, the process of sacrifice and how, you know, one thing comes into the world and one thing leaves. And you have this sort of like theme of mirroring and exchange that runs through the entire three-parter, which is like, and again, Carter's sense of structuring in terms of like just, you know, in terms of structuring a script isn't always particularly tight, but his structure in terms of storytelling is generally relatively good. As in, like, he understands how, you know, how narrative setup and payoff works, you know, enough in a very fundamental level. And you have that throughout the show. You have this weird sort of doubling and mirroring effect. So, for example, like, across the run of the X-Files, Mulder dying at the end of Anasazi obviously mirrors Scully, you know, getting abducted, dying, and resurrected around one breath. You have Scully going to hypnotherapy here, which obviously mirrors Mulder's experience in hypnotherapy. You have, like, later on, like, dying and getting reborn becomes an X-Files rite of passage. You know, you have, obviously, Skinner doing it later in the third season with Apocrypha and Piper Maru. You have, in the eighth season, you have Doggett doing it in The Gift. But you even have, like, for example, the death of Melissa is a double doubling, if you will, because it's, first of all, it's her being confused with Scully. She's a replacement for Scully. She's killed by Krycek, who assumes that she's Scully because Krycek is massively, massively incompetent. But you also have the idea within the structure of the narrative that Melissa's death is effectively a sacrifice or a swap in storytelling terms for Mulder. Like, and this is something like basic, like, narrative sort of storytelling structure. When you tell a story and you have a massive loss, traditionally you can only, it's very hard to sell the audience on the reversal of that loss unless you offer something that feels equivalent in weight. So think of, for example, the death of Spock at the end of Star Trek II, where Spock dies to sacrifice the Enterprise, right? And then the writers have to get Spock back at the end of Star Trek III. And in order to get Spock back at the end of Star Trek III without it feeling like a massive cop-out, they have to sacrifice, Kirk has to sacrifice the Enterprise, his son, and his career in order to get Spock back. And it feels like a worthy sort of dramatic sacrifice. And that's part of the issue with Star Trek Into Darkness, where, like, Kirk dies, but you don't have a sort of a comparative sacrifice to get him back, so it doesn't have narrative weight. So part of me feels like the death of Melissa in The Blessing Way, or like the shooting of Melissa in The Blessing Way, and, you know, her death in Paperclip, is Carter effectively doing that sort of narrative sleight of hand. And he alludes to, he actually, like, calls it out with Hosteen, where he talks about, like, you know, one thing entering the world and one thing leaving, and basically this idea of exchange and sort of balance and equilibrium. Where so Mulder gets to come back from the dead after being burnt alive in Anasazi, but the flip side of that is that Melissa dies. And it's, from a narrative point of view, it's very efficient, because it does mean that you get through the three-parter without feeling like Mulder cheated death, or without thinking our heroes escaped without any consequences. But it's also, you're right when you say it's very cynical. It's very calculated. Like, Melissa has been around since, you know, she's popped up in one breath. She hasn't really been used since. And she's an interesting character, but she's relatively underdeveloped. I mean, you arguably discover more about her, like, after her death in later episodes like Christmas Carol and Emily, where Scully sort of talks about her, than you know about her when she's alive. So it is very cynical. And in some ways, it's, you know, it feels like an attempt to generate tension and to throw more hurt on top of Scully. Like, it's not as if Scully hasn't suffered enough. In terms of, like, Mulder's quest for whatever, it does feel a little bit like a suffering, you know, cherry on top of, like, a sundae of heartbreak.
It is in that sense. I think it's another kind of gut punch, really. And it you know, it all continues Scully's, you know, that a big thing in this, you know, as she goes through the episode, you know, and she's balancing having discovering this chip quite randomly in many ways, you know, having going through the FBI scanner and suddenly, oh, hang on, what's that in the back of my neck? And then starting to realize there's something strange going on, and then balancing it with this intrigue of, are they going to kill her? You know, she doesn't have the tape, but do they think she has the tape? You know, what's going to happen? What's Skinner's role in all this? What's he not saying? Who's he playing? So to have all that involved and then bring Melissa into it is, you know, it's a mixed bag. I mean, so in some respects it works, but I think in others it is a bit cynical, as you say, and it is a bit of a shame. But then, I mean, In terms of Skinner's role in this, just while we're on the subject, I think this is a good example of one of those episodes that really works hard to sort of compromise Skinner. You know, and this is something that the show returns to again and again and again and again, right up until the last season specifically, you know, season 11, which really tried to get back to this. But it's Skinner caught in the middle of the shadowy forces on the one side and Scully and Mulder on the other. And, you know, in this, he doesn't really come off very well, does he, overall, Skinner?
I think that there's a point, though, like, And you're right when you say, like, Skinner does this over and over to the point where it feels almost like a cliche. Like, there was a point in the 11th season where they were like, can we trust Skinner? And I'm like, guys, you have had this conversation, like, six times over the past 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And the answer has generally been yes, yep. unless there are major, like, yeah. extenuating circumstances, like Krychek trying to kill him. In hindsight, it does seem a little bit much, but I think in the context of the time, I would be quite happy with this if this had been the last time they played that card. And it feels like an appropriate point at which you can, like, an appropriate last point at which you can play this, because, like, again, not to get too spoilery, but later on in the season you have Skinner going through his own, like, Skinner's obviously, he helped Mulder in, like, One Breath, where he told the story about his own, like, you know, near-death experience in Vietnam, and he, you know, pointed in the direction of the smoking man and stuff like that, and he's been friendly to the X-Files before, but, you know, there's still a sense of kind of how far that loyalty goes and sort of, you know, how far it goes in terms of his personal life. But the issue is that later on in the third season, you have Skinner basically experience a bunch of humiliations and his own suffering Sunday, so to speak, in, you know, obviously Piper Ruin Apocrypha, but also later on with Avatar. Where, like, Skinner's loyalty to Mulder and Scully becomes almost, it should in theory be unimpeachable. But the show keeps going back to that particular well. I feel like in The Blessing Way, it's earned, because he hasn't yet sort of done that conga line of, can we trust him? Maybe. Can we trust him? Well, yes. Can we trust him? I'm not sure. here it feels more like, well, you know, he's been on our side before, but we've never really been put in a corner like this. And so we don't know how he'll react to it. And I quite like the ambiguity of it. I do like, by the way, the well-manicured man's sort of explanation to Scully of how people are going to kill him, how people are going to kill her, where he's like, you know, it'll be two people you don't know, or maybe it'll be someone you know, or they'll either arrange a meeting with you, or they'll kill you in your own home unannounced. And you're like, dude, like, you could be a little bit more specific about the mechanics of how you're going to kill her.
Yeah.
It's like, By the information that the well-manicured man gives her, Frohickey could be the assassin. But it works in the context of the episode, because I feel like Skinner's, like, he's, this is, I think, the first episode where Mitch Pileggi's credit is also starring. So I think that he's still an unknown enough quantity that you can play that card. And again, Pileggi does Conflicted so well. Like, one of the reasons why the show keeps going back to that cliche of, can we trust Skinner? Is there enough Skinner in the game? Is because Pileggi does this wonderful sort of angsty, sort of like underspoken, sort of like, you know, you can tell that there's a lot happening underneath that stern, stoic exterior. He does it beautifully. And so, like, writing an episode with Skinner where he doesn't get to do that feels almost like a disservice to the actor. And you can sort of see why they go back to it. But yeah, I actually like it here. I feel like here's approaching the last time that you can get away with that.
Yeah, it builds to a good cliffhanger. You know, a cliffhanger where at this stage, you know, when you watch it from a distance, you know really that it's all going to work out okay in the end in terms of Skinner, because you know the character a bit better. But at the time, there still is that, like you say, there is that ambiguity about him. So I think to have it end with him and Scully pulling guns on each other, having got to the point where they genuinely don't know whether they can trust each other, Scully in particular can trust Skinner, you know, and be at the point where they, you know, it's a standoff. I think it's a touch engineered in order to be able to get Mulder bursting in the next episode and going, yeah, I'm back, woo! But I think it does work to end an episode which is, you know, a very much a sort of, in some respects, a character-based stopgap between Anasazi and Paperclip, to end it on some level of, you know, stakes, I suppose. So in that context, I think it works quite well, really. And you know, it plays, like you say, it plays Skinner in that way nicely. And it, you know, and ends things well. So that builds up an interesting cliffhanger for the Blessing Way. But we're not quite done yet. We're going to move into getting some listener feedback on the episode, where we'll cover a few more details. Right, so yeah, we on the Facebook group, the XCast Basement and XCast X-Files Podcast Fan Group, do look it up, guys, on Facebook, because it's a brilliant group, over 500 members, lots going on, lots of chatter on a daily basis, some amazing people in there. We have, for each episode, now it's going to be a bit sporadic, this, because it's me and I'm massively disorganized, we've recorded a lot of season three out of order. So, you know, some we did earlier, some we did later. In fact, this is one of the latest, we've done loads before this. So, so it's, you know, the blessing way, even though it's the first episode. So what I'm trying to say is that not every episode of season three may have listener feedback. But the plan is to have it in all of them going forward as much as possible. So in this episode, we do have some feedback from the XCast podcast listeners. So yeah, let's see what we got. So Adam Silver, one of our patrons, says, "I think it's underrated and sort of gets overshadowed by the praise for Anastasia and Paperclip. It's one of the best season premieres and the best middle part of a trilogy. I know Darren and others criticise it for not being exactly what you'd expect coming back from Anasazi, but isn't that what's cool about the X-Files? It also introduces the Syndicate and Scully's implant, so I disagree it just spins its wheels before Paperclip. I personally find the Navajo / dream sequences very interesting and something you wouldn't see elsewhere. Again, isn't that part of why we love the show?" What do you think, Darren? I mean, in terms of the dream sequences, we haven't talked about that too much yet. So do you agree with Adam there?
I actually agree kind of a reasonable amount, or a, you know, great deal. As I said at the start, like, I admire the fact that The X-Files is a show that can do that. And Carter in particular is a writer and producer who's willing to do that. And I think that, like, subverting those expectations and playing with those expectations at a point when you would not expect them to is refreshing and exciting. I don't think it always works. I would argue that it doesn't necessarily work here, but I do appreciate that it's been done. And, like, I think, you know, we talked about the episode. Generally speaking, we're relatively positive about this. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of it, but even I find things that I really, really like about it. But onto the dream sequences, because the dream sequences kind of get to the stuff that I'm not particularly fond of about the episode, which is the Native American stuff in this episode in particular, but in the X-Files as a whole. And, like, I understand thematically why Carter's doing that, because obviously it's hugely thematically relevant to the story he's telling, which is the story of colonization. And that as a metaphor for, you know, certain anxieties in the American psyche. The idea that, you know, the Americans who are, you know, European settlers who came to the American continent and claimed it as their own and led to, you know, the genocide and near extinction of the Native American people, including, you know, the extinction of particular tribes. But that then being reflected back as an anxiety with, like, alien colonization of Earth and the idea that, you know, Earth itself will be colonized by settlers from somewhere else that will engineer their own equivalent of the smallpox virus. The smallpox virus obviously having its own cultural connotations in that relationship between European settlers and Native Americans. But, and I appreciate that thematically. I think that's very clever. And I think it's very well done. And I like the use of, like, Western iconography throughout the show. Like, it's no coincidence, for example, that, you know, it's an abandoned train on the Pacific Railroad that Mulder finds, the expression of manifest destiny and the push westward and stuff like that. And it's, you know, no coincidence, obviously, that ties into slavery and this idea that hybrids are going to be created as slaves, that humanity will be enslaved, their bodies sort of abused and sort of used to, you know, perpetuate this alien menace. And I think that's very clever. On the other hand, there's a lot of the stuff in here which is very new agey in a way that, like, a lot of 90s television was new agey. And, like, I think the example that I always come back to here, and I'm sorry, I am a Star Trek fan, is Chakotay Chakotay on Star Trek Voyager, which would have premiered back at the start of 1995 with Caretaker, where Michael Piller, who was the producer there, was a huge fan of, like, new age philosophy. And he got, I think, Jamaic Highwater, who is... many Native Americans would consider to be a charlatan, who to consult on the character of Chakotay and to inform his, you know, the way he'd be written and the way that his culture would be portrayed. And, like, Chakotay on Voyager is, like, perhaps the worst example, because it's, you know, he treats his religion as a party favor that he can perform for his crewmates. He's, you know, he's introduced going off in a shuttle meditating, saying Akuchi Maya. And it's really condescending. It's really patronizing. And there are aliens who have been in, like, advanced contact with Native Americans in a way that condescendingly explains why their culture was so advanced, and which obviously has really, really terrible racial connotations. Now, Carter is much, much better than that. I should be entirely explicit. And Carter, to be fair, when he was writing The Blessing Way, much like I think earlier in the show, he went to visit the FBI in order to more thoroughly understand the workings of the Hoover Building and how the organization worked. He did something similar with the Blessing Way, where I believe he actually took part in a Navajo ceremony, which he was invited to attend in order to give him a bit more understanding of how the culture worked and how the rituals worked. And there's a lot of attention to detail in here that is, you know, absent from a lot of the other contemporary sort of 90s Native American sort of fixated New Agey stuff, which always feels like exploitational and like charlatan in nature. But at the same time, there's still something very cliche in the way that Hosteen talks in these sort of like expanded metaphors about like the natural world, and, you know, talking about how, you know, Fox Mulder hid like a rabbit or a fox, and sort of this sort of belabored point, it doesn't work for me, and it feels a little uncomfortable and it feels a little awkward, and it hasn't aged very well, in the same way that like Babylon feels like a 90s episode that has not aged really, really well. And I think, again, I admire the ambition of Babylon. I admire the fact that Carter made something like Babylon, but there's also a sense that there's something a little tone deaf in it. And there's that always bothers me about the Native American episode of The X-Files.
It does come across as quite hokey, you know, and I suppose you've got the whole Deep Throat and Bill Mulder popping in to do a little bit of a monologue and, you know, in those sequences, which... Again, you know, it's great to see those actors back. Don't get me wrong, especially Jerry Harding, because he's just great. You know, even delivering a monologue, he's great. But you do feel like it's just a little bit cheesy, you know, a little bit like too on the nose. I suppose it's Mulder's version of what happens to Scully in One Breath, where she sees William, you know, in the room, you know, and he says Starbuck and all. But there's something about that worked better. And I don't know what it is, but maybe it was the fact there was more of a sort of an emotional thing going on there.
Whereas this is just theme as opposed to character. So William telling Scully to go on was, you know, a father talking to a daughter, like emotionally. Whereas here it's very much like a broad philosophical meditation on memory and guilt and truth. Just when you mention the monologues, so I actually do like, again, we talked about this when we talked about like the monologues in general. I like a lot of the ideas in the monologues. They're very literate, they're very philosophical. And there's something in the monologues in The Blessing Way from Deep Throat, I think it struck me the last time I rewatched, and it sticks out at me again. It's the bit where he talks about like the idea of truth, like truth existing as this, like of this good, but that truth is basically no justice, you know, that where he'll find truth if Mulder crosses over, he'll find the truth that he wants, but there's no justice or judgment without which truth is a vast dead hollow. And it kind of got me thinking about like the X-Files as a whole, because there's this thing that I noticed, particularly when you get to the sixth season, where it's never really explained why Mulder, what Mulder is planning to do with the truth, like what the truth is for Mulder, what purpose it is, what justice or judgment can be derived from it. It's kind of interesting to see Deep Throat make the point that like truth on its own is not enough, that there needs to be something that comes with that truth. There needs to be action following from it or balance restored from it. Whereas over the course of the show, like, there's never any sense of what Mulder actually does with the truth beyond, like, internalizing it or using it to come to some philosophical understanding within himself. Like, there's never a moment where the cigarette-smoking man is placed on trial and Mulder gets to, you know, in front of the entire world announce that he's vindicated. You could argue there's an aspect of that to the truth where that's subverted, where Mulder wants to, you know, give this big courtroom sort of validation of what he's doing but can't. But there's never a moment where, like, Mulder leaks the press and it's exposed the world and the truth, you know, the syndicate, like, face the consequences of their action in a way that they wouldn't have if Mulder hadn't have found the truth. And it's kind of strange. I wonder about that when I hear that monologue, when I read that monologue back. Like, is there a truth and justice? Is there justice or judgment in the X-Files, or is truth itself its own reward?
Well, one of the things I think I like about season 11 in particular is that middle age Mulder, you know, heading towards old age Mulder, doesn't seem to have that same sense of need for that truth anymore. You know, there's a little bit more about how he's quite jaded. You know, he feels, and part of it I think is David Duchovny's performance, you know, in the latest season and everything like that. And obviously, you know, he's he's still involved in the conspiracy stuff, but in the new episodes, and I suppose it's part of the plotting, but it's much more about him trying to just stop these people doing what they're doing, as opposed to actually, you know, looking for the truth in quite the same way. And I quite like the way he's ended up that way, because I suppose after 30 years of getting nowhere, you know, and actually, like, you know, being told, oh, this is the truth, oh, no, it's not really. Oh, this is the truth, oh, no, it's not really. Oh, the world's going to end in 2012. No, it hasn't. You know, you would get to a point where you're a bit like, oh, I just don't care anymore. You know, and I suppose the closest you had was, I always think of Biogenesis with this, where Scully says to him, you know, they're all dead, all the men are dead, you know, you've won. What is there more to do or to find? And he says, my sister. And then when he finds the truth about Samantha in closure, that is the open question then. Well, what's left? You know, what is the point of all of this? So it is an interesting idea. And I suppose the whole concept of the X-Files is that the point is that you're never going to get it. You're never going to quite reach that equilibrium with the truth, because the truth, and this was obviously played with a lot in season 11 with forehead sweat and things like that. The truth is not really anything anymore. There is no truth. And that's I think what the X-Files has eventually evolved into, really. But it's interesting how he was wondering about that, Chris Carter, really this far back, you know, towards the beginning, really, in many ways.
It is. And I mean, I admire the fact that, like, he asked the question. And part of me wonders if he was asking the question because he doesn't necessarily know the answer himself as a writer. And I mean, we talk about, like, Carter maybe not knowing all the contours of what he was doing as he was doing it, and maybe making some of it up as he was going along. And I suspect that was very much the case. But I admire the fact that you can see him working through these questions as he's going, and the fact that he has the luxury of, like, course correcting, and not course correcting, but also, like, exploring and sort of probing and sort of, like, poking at the stories that he's telling. Like, for example, you know, having Mulder go through a crisis of faith later where he wonders, you know, does any of this actually matter, or is this all just one big lie? And if it's a big lie, is he perpetuating it? And even, yeah, so I feel like, yeah, maybe there is some value in having Deep Throat ask, well, look, truth is good, but, you know, truth has to lead to something more, even if we're not entirely sure what that more is.
I think that's a good way of looking at it, really.
Of course, that was the 90s, so you know, now we're like, I will take any truth. Give me truth. Truth is enough.
Yeah, just give me something to believe in. But you weren't the only one who wasn't sure about all this with the Native American stuff. Andrew Blako, another one of our patrons and occasional guest, does say, there's just something about the whole Native American healing ritual / vigil that doesn't work for me. Mulder floating in the dark on a bed of brush feels hokey. This is an instance where the follow-up paperclip is so much stronger. So yeah, he's in agreement with you there.
It's the black polo necks as well that do it. It's like it's like Heaven has, like, a really stylish 90s, you know, nightclub dress code going on. And obviously it exists so that you can do, like, you can have the starry background, which is its own sort of 90s music video cliche going on there as well. Like, I mean, I admire, like, listening to or reading up on this was a very difficult shoot from a technical perspective, but it does look very much like a music video in some respects.
Yeah, an 80s music video as well, I'd say. But yeah, Sarah Devincom agrees with the point about what Deep Throat says. She says, I love Deep Throat's speech, how truth makes no sense without justice. I think it's a very accurate point. Mulder wanted the truth, but he also wanted justice, but might forget it sometimes. I think justice is a very pure intention. She says, I like what Albert Hochstein says about memory. It's really accurate in the way that history is based upon the winners, because history is told by the majority, so what's left is to any kind of minority is memory, and it can be as strong as written history. I think it was powerful and is still very accurate. And, you know, yeah, it goes into the kind of things we've been talking about already, you know, with that whole thing about history being written by the winners. I was thinking that when I was watching this. There is that element, isn't there, of what Albert Hochstein says is essentially that these guys have created their own truth. They've created their own history. You know, they've falsified what is real. And are making it, and you know, that's exactly what the well manicured man is saying about, you know, we predict the future, we invent it. You know, it's that whole thing of you're not just inventing the future, but you're rewriting the past.
There's also something more ominous in the opening monologue where Hochstein, you know, points out that the memory only lives as long as the last person who remembers it. And that makes you then sort of think about, like, the policies that are being enacted and what's happening to these groups who have these memories, and these memories being the total relic of their culture. culture, and this idea that exterminating people, you know, exterminate people is horrific and monstrous of itself, but the idea that it might be employed purely as a way of rewriting history, that it's a, you know, you're manipulating narrative, that genocide and mass murder are just tools to curate this story that you want to tell, it's absolutely horrific. And I mean, the show makes it very clear that that's what's happening repeatedly over the course of the narrative. I mean, even in this case, you have like the well-manicured man pointing out that the cigarette-smoking man never met a problem he didn't think he could solve with bullets. But it's kind of horrific that, yeah, all of this suffering and all of this hurt and all of this loss is simply an attempt to control the story. Like it would be one thing if these people were dying because somebody hated them or because, you know, there was some sort of greater motivation or there was a reason for it, but instead it's just fighting for control of a story or a narrative, and it's harrowing, it's really, really affecting and haunting.
It's one of those things that sort of feels even more, you know, relevant in many ways, although not everyone necessarily thinks that it would necessarily work in the same way in this day and age. Jeremy Daniels says, you know, I gave this a recent rewatch. It's not nearly as bad in the way that the middle of Carter's of the trilogies are, but it's not great either. I think Albert Hustin is the kind of character that would not fly today. He's basically a mystical other figure. It's very 90s, new agey, and very much of its time, which is what we've said, you know. And it's, I suppose there is that aspect of it where people can see that it is of its time as an episode, you know, and it doesn't quite work on all those levels. But then, you know, equally, you have got people who think a lot of it. You know, Marlene Stemmy says, The Blessing Way has that suspended in time luminal quality of many of the middle trilogy episodes. I can't decide if the episode's reputation suffers from its relative quietness or if the dorky Mulder in the Christmas tree visual is really that bad.
That's it. That's the aesthetic. Forget your 80s pop video. That's it in a nutshell.
Mulder in the Christmas tree. She says, I love the authenticity of the Blessing Way ritual and was more than thrilled when this ritual came up in a Native American religion class that I took in college. I also like the dream sequence in which Mulder, in his vision, seems to connect to Scully after her altered state hypnosis session is repeated in Amor Fati, when Mulder and Scully connect through his dream life and her prayer with Albert Hustin. And obviously, we're a long way away from the Biogenesis trilogy, but obviously that's in some ways a sequel. You know, it features Albert Hustin again. That's an interesting point, you know, that there might be some level of connection there.
Oh, there undoubtedly is. Like, one of the things I really like about The X-Files is the way in which it sort of echoes and reverberates and rhymes. And not in a way that feels like Carter necessarily going back and doing the same thing over and over again, although you can argue that in some cases. More in a case of, like, Carter having a set of, like, particular beats that he likes to hit and hitting them in a particular rhythm in such a way that they sort of create, like, a tempo and a cadence. Like, there's a sense that you can see certain storylines sort of starting and certain thematic ideas developing, and then you can see them sort of mirrored in later stories. So, for example, you have, like, Colony and Endgame, like, almost dovetail perfectly into, like, Patient X and The Red and the Black, where you have this idea of, like, a war in heaven raging, which mankind cannot properly understand. You have, obviously, this trilogy and the Biogenesis trilogy, but even this trilogy and if you want to go with the Redux trilogy, which has a similar sort of thing, except with the dynamics reversed, where Scully spends the middle episode in hospital, for example, and where Mulder once again finds himself, you know, dying and getting reborn, only to come back and save the day at the last possible minute. Like, there's a lot of similar sort of structural beats without it feeling like self-plagiarism, which I really, really like. And I mean, it wasn't all planned. It couldn't possibly have been planned when you're talking 200 odd episodes, but it does when you're rewatching it, and particularly when you're rewatching it with the Podwatch. And I know that, you know, we pointed out how wonderful an accomplishment the Podwatch was before, and it really was. And, like, congratulations, Tony. Never miss a chance to, like, state how amazed I am that you physically did that.
I thought you were going to say never do it again.
I would hope that you reach that epiphany yourself. I mean, I would love for you to do it again, but I recognize that for your own health, that may not be a good idea.
My own sanity, but thank you.
But, like, watching the episodes in such rapid succession and sort of, like, blazing through them, because you were doing it one stage four a day, and I would occasionally try and keep up with them. You would basically find that you would recognize certain beats and rhythms and familiar patterns that played out, which demonstrated, like, how internally consistent the show was on a thematic level, if not always on a plotting or even characterization level. And it holds up very, very well.
It's interesting to see that. And I think that's one of the boons of the Podwatch, really, and that people may have experienced the show in that different kind of way. Because obviously, you know, when it was on, you were watching it week by week, season by season. And it's only when you really watch something in quite quick succession that you start to see some of the aspects that something like this might have. So it's good in that sense. And I suppose, you know, the Blessing Way, thank you to everyone who contributed, by the way. And those of you whose comments I didn't get to read out, thank you anyway. I'm sure you'll make an appearance on the podcast soon in our listener feedback section. But I suppose the Blessing Way, you know, is one of those episodes that has a lot of flaws. You know, it's a necessary evil, I suppose, between two fantastic episodes. But, you know, I think we've chewed around a lot of it, really. And I think I'd leave thinking that it's maybe something that we're better off having got than not, I think.
Yes.
You know, in terms of some of the things it does, some of the character points it has, some of the ideas involved, I think it's part of the unopened file package, I suppose.
I mean, more than that, I would much rather, like, the X-Files would be a much lesser show, really, ignoring the quality of this episode. Like, and I mean, we can argue over the quality of this episode. I think it's not great, but I admire the ambition behind it. But the X-Files as a show would be a much weaker show if it were not willing to take the chance on something like this. It would be a much more generic show. It would be a much more stable show. It would be maybe even a much more consistent show. But it wouldn't be as brilliant and as provocative and as, like, enduring, I think, like, as this is. Like, I think that, you know, this is the logic that gets you episodes like Triangle in the sixth season. It's like the try anything, it's the throw out the rule book, it's the, you know, like, if someone were to sit Carter down and say, if you were to sit somebody down and say, look, you had a second season finale which was phenomenal, it got great reviews, lots of people loved it, got positive media coverage, everybody's on edge, everybody wants to know how you're going to resolve that cliffhanger, and you're like, well, my plan is actually to have the main character experience a Native American rebirth ritual in which you'll be visited by the ghosts of two surrogate father figures, in which they'll speak in long extended monologues about philosophical truths that I deem essential to the core of this series. Any network executive would look at you like you had two heads.
Yeah.
But Carter did it. And, like, you can't put into words how incredible it is that he did that, that he was able to do that, and how much doing that allowed him to do stuff later on. Like, not even him to do stuff, but to allow the writers under him to attempt stuff that, again, any 90s television show would have been like, what are you doing? And like, this is the quintessential what are you doing episode, except it's the gigantic season premiere with everything riding on it, which makes the gamble even greater, which makes my admiration for attempting it even greater. So I love that the X-Files tried this, even if I don't love the episode itself.
And this is, of course, the beginning of season 3. And just in case it's not been made clear on other podcasts or generally through the Twitter or the Facebook groups and things like that, the plan is that we're going to release season 3 weekly, like we always have done, on a Friday. But every couple of weeks, and maybe, you know, every week for a while, we'll see. But at least every couple of weeks on a Tuesday, we're going to get a supplementary episode, which is going to be about an X-Files topic of some kind. So it could be one of the round tables we do with the patrons, it could be an episode comparison to a movie, it could be all, we've got loads of ideas. We've even got a shipper special coming up for that aspect of the X-Cast fandom, which is territory we haven't necessarily fully explored.
Who are they shipping, Tony? I'm worried about X-Cast shippers now.
It's me and Carl, let's be honest.
You are the one true pairing.
We are. Carly, that'd work, wouldn't it? Actually, as a joint name. Sorry, Carl, I'll never say that again. But yeah,
opposed to Tarl. Tarl works.
Tarl would work. Okay, so yeah, hashtag Tarl. There you go, guys. Do what you will with that. Don't, please. But yeah, we'll have a supplementary episode every couple of weeks with some great topics. So that's how we're slightly expanding the X-Cast out. And of course, we're on the build-up to the X-Cast Live in September, which is me attempting to do this for 24 hours live without a break. You do know about this.
No, you realize, like, when I said that, when people pointed out that, like, doing the pod watch was a crazy ambitious thing that probably would have killed a lesser man, that wasn't, like, do something more, right?
Yeah, I just came up with this now. This is the challenge. No, it's you seriously, you must have heard of this, Darren.
No.
Really? Okay, right, well, I was going to invite you on.
I'm sorry, I've been living under a rock in an Arizona desert. I'm unsure how I ended up there.
Yeah, September the 1st, for the Alzheimer's Society, I'm doing a charity 24-hour live marathon XCast, which already has a couple of interesting, good guests. We've got some of the podcasts. Hopefully, if you're around, you might be able to join. It's on a Saturday, so... you know, people Cameo. Might be a little bit more free. Yeah, cool. Okay. But yeah, we hope...
And I now committed live on air.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, none of the editing shears. I don't know how it's going to come off, but hopefully the aim is to raise at least £1,000 for Alzheimer's along the way, as well as celebrating 25 years of the... Because it's 25 years in 24 hours. That's the theme, basically. Because September is the anniversary, of course. 25 years of the X-Files. So yeah, you can... if you go onto the Facebook... group, you can just go to our Just Giving page, Just Giving the XCast. Or you can, if you can donate, that'd be amazing for the XCast Live. Doesn't go to me, doesn't go to us. It's purely for the Alzheimer's to help people with that difficult, horrible disease. So we got that coming up. So I'm on the countdown to that now. So I'm not going to be on as many season 3 episodes as I was in season 2. To be honest, we've got a lot of other brilliant members of the team: Carl, Sarah, Clara, yourself, Darren, because you're doing next week with Chris Knowles. You and Chris Knowles doing Paperclip, which is...
Really looking forward to that, actually. Really looking
forward. It's going to be an epic. So yeah, it's not just going to be me every week, and I might be gone for a while, but I'm still around. I'm planning for the marathon. I've been training
for this. How do you train? I just have this image of Tony running up and down stairs while producing banter about, like, the Mulder and Scully relationship. It's like, you know, he's jogging with Carl, and Carl's like, okay, I need 10 minutes on Skinner, stat!
It might yet get to that, to be fair. Yeah. I feel
lifting reference books over his head. It's like...
It's like, just, you need to play Eye of the Tiger at the same time. Yeah. You know, it's basically just going to be a montage sequence. Me pushing a big sledge through the snow while reciting facts about the X-Files.
Practicing your Chris Carter monologue as you walk through long grey corridors.
Yeah, some exciting stuff coming up for the X-Cast guys. We haven't got any pod watches, we haven't got any new seasons to hack into, but the X-Files isn't going anywhere, and nor are we. So, fun times to come. So, yeah, I'll be back soon. Darren will be back even sooner, but Darren, before...
Get it sooner.
Yeah, you are the thinker. And before you do return, why don't you point people to online to where they can find you for more Darren Mooney?
Yep, so you can find me online at Twitter at Darren_Mooney. You can find me at the Movie Blog, spelled with a 0 instead of an O in movie. I also co-host the Scan On podcast, which is an Irish podcast looking at film on a weekly basis. I may have recently popped up on Set the Tape. I was very pleased to be invited on that. And I co-host a podcast, The 250, which looks at the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time, basically one movie at a time, one a week from now until the end of time, because the list is constantly changing. But we very recently had Tony on as a guest at one of our most popular episodes, Infinity War. And that's a really good place to start if you're looking to jump in there. Mm. And I think recently we also had The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is also great fun. I love my Wes Anderson sort of joints.
Absolutely, that film is a masterpiece. I love that film so much. That's on my 250. Absolutely, definitely. But yeah, 250 is a fantastic show. And Darren mentioned Set the Tape, which is the podcast for my website, www.setthetape.com. So do give that a listen. And you can find me and all my ramblings at AJ Black Writer if you want to look me up. But we'll be back next week. All the details of where the X-Cast is will be in the bit I do afterwards, after this. It's coming. So until then, remember, as always, trust no one. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support the XCast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/thexcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/thexcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at IAmWillAye.